Welcome to the Food and Farming podcast from AHDB, keeping levy payers informed and at the heart of the conversation.
Hello, it's Liz Jennifer again. I'm here talking to John Morgan from Creedy Associate. As you remember, if you listened to the first podcast, we're talking about Chris and Louise's farm near Grantham. So it's a beef and lamb strategic farm. And we are really going to talk about sort of strategies to deal with their low P levels. So if you remember, the pH is generally 6.5 to 7.5 on most of their fields. P's are normally zeros to ones, K's one-ish, so okay for K index, and magnesiums are generally twos to threes. So in terms of chatting to John, we're really going to talk about options that are available to Chris this sort of this season to really deal with this establishment of his herbal lays and also the longer term plans really. So, John, in terms of what's your, you've been involved in nutrient management for quite a while.
I have. too long to work out how long, Liz, yeah.
No, and you have a major issue against kilos. You're like a unit. You like talking units.
I have actually matured, you'll be pleased to know. I can used to be able to do both, but I tend to go in kilos. I mean, soil pH is really important, okay? Appreciate this farm has got a very good level of soil pH, but it, low pH acid soils or even very alkaline soils can really restrict the availability of the core kind of macronutrients, nitrogen, phosphate, potash. So it's first thing to tick off is that the pH is not an issue. Potash at one, very difficult to get potash indexes much above two. One is quite normal. What it's really saying is that that's sufficient potash, but we need to keep adding maintenance requirements each year to ensure that we don't drift any lower down than that. But as you quite rightly picked up and obviously talked about before, the phosphate levels of zero or very low phosphate levels is a big challenge. Phosphate is primarily linked to root development. And if we want to establish any new lay, be it herbal lay or grass lay or maize, whatever it may be, we need phosphorus to give those roots chance to their full chance. So short term, I think we're looking for very available, very soluble, probably inorganic phosphate fertilizer, DAP or TSP, both of which will supply phosphate right next to the, or very available phosphate near those young, new developed roots.
And there's sort of, we quite often have the chat about what some of those products also do. So there is a bit of acidifying effects in there of TSP perhaps, or gene, if they are perceived to be not great for soil health, but in this regard they're doing a job just to get that P level where it needs to be in the root zone.
Yeah, I think that's right, Liz. Yes, they are. They're the only real things that are going to ensure that we've got sufficient phosphate there. Personally, I think we sometimes over egg the negative impacts. I wouldn't lose any sleep about it. The importance of getting phosphate available to those new roots is going to override any negatives. Something I think it might be worth thinking about is how we or where we apply that phosphate, because the levels are so low, we probably want to be thinking a little bit about, for example, we don't want to plow it under, we don't want to probably apply it to the surface. We probably want to be mixing that within the, during the preparation of the seed bed so that we've got phosphate throughout the kind of early rooting zone.
So his plan for establishment is it will be a subsoiled, it was sprayed off, subsoiled, and then there will be some surface cultivation, but it won't be ploughed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, his plan is to mix it into that surface cultivation.
Yeah. So I would put it on before he does his kind of surface cultivation to give it as much chance to mix throughout that rooting zone as possible.
And we have, June, he's got a price for some pea grow, which is a burnt poultry litter sort of product. There's quite a few of those, or there's been come sort of meat and bone meal equivalents or rendering plants. And what are your thoughts on those sort of products?
I think anything that will add phosphate to that field is going to be a benefit. I mean, most products you can kind of quantify or calculate the available versus the kind of organic element of it. So typically, for example, dairy slurry would have, I think, 50% available phosphate. Compared to FYM, which will be about 60%. So I don't know actually what the available phosphate levels of these various other products are, but they'll all have some really useful available phosphate. And anything that's going to boost that, the better. But what we need to, at this early stage, recognize is the available stuff that's going to be useful the longer term inorganic stuff that will break down. Yes, great, but we've got to get past the first square on the board and not worry about getting around the corner.
And that basis, with as those seedlings are starting, we need that phosphate to, it doesn't move very far, does it, in soil? So it needs to be basically sitting right by that, the seed and the developing seedling.
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's why, for example, when we're growing maize, we actually, if the field is low in phosphate, we put the phosphate right next to the maize seed in a kind of precision drill, because it's no good being a foot away. It needs it, you know, right next to it. So again, how is he planning to drill this herbal layer or sow this herbal layer? Would it be broadcast seed or?
Direct drill is the plan.
Direct drill. So, you know, it's not impossible. I don't know what, is whether there's any, the ability to place fertilizer. That might be something to have a chat with the contractor or with or look at the drill to see whether there is the opportunity of getting that phosphate exactly where we need it.
So in terms of those product choices, so we've got to look at, if the decision is to go to this pea grow type product, we've got to look at the availability and take that into consideration in terms of how much is spread. It also, I suppose, quite a, like other organic materials, it brings other things with it, doesn't it? So we need to check whether we still doing the sulfur's coming with it and all sorts of other things. And the idea of getting it really in that rooting zone for when that crop established, it needs to be next door.
Yeah, quite exactly.
That analogy doesn't quite work in soil, but you mean it's got to be quite close to where that seed is.
You know, index zero phosphate is saying there's not a lot about, and that it really is. It's imperative that not only do we get enough for the annual requirement, but we must certainly get it close.
Okay.
It's very rare to come across index zeros.
So if I said it before on the first podcast, which is the availability of other, like in the dream world, we'd like to go to organic materials or get like organic manures. So he generates a little bit of sheep muck every year. Where he's situated in the big arable area, they're sucking out a lot of the organic materials that are produced in that area, and it's not a big dairy or pig area. So I suppose longer term, we're just trying to find some reliable sources of other things that could be used to build those indices up.
Yeah, I think that's right. I've said before, I think, you know, we tend to get very het up about moving kind of conventional farmyard manure or slurries very far on the road, although we do move inorganic bag fertilizer hundreds of miles often on the road. So I think in the case that you're talking about, it's not impossible to look a bit further afield than the immediate locality. Dairy slurry full of very available nutrient and a really good source of nutrient. Farmyard manure, dung, there's a lot of nutrient there. A lot of it is locked up though in organic matter, and it will take time to release. So it will do the field a world of good over time. But many of those nutrients are locked up in the lumps, as I like to call it. If you think about it, if there's a lump, the lumps take time to break down and we want it immediately. So liquid is often good. Poultry manure, very high in nutrient, particularly nitrogen. Again, good source. And those poultry farms and dairy farms, to be fair, the more the world looks at their nutrient position, the more important it is for them to seriously think about balancing their situation. And exporting is a big part of their future. So I think if you find the doors to knock on, you'll find dairy farmers and poultry farmers will be very delighted to supply you with organic manure over time.
What's the highest P index you've seen on farm?
I have seen many sevens. I have seen 1.9, and I see lots of fours and fives. And they're usually, the super high ones are nearly always associated with poultry farms who for many years have spread the manure on very small acreages. What you have to remember is every load of feed that comes into a farm, and there are a lot on a poultry farm, every load brings with it not just the energy and protein that we tend to think about when we're rationing stock, but it brings with it all manner of really good, useful nutrients. And in a perfect world, we should be recreating that virtuous circle, which is that nutrient goes back to the fields that grew the grain, whatever that goes down the lane. So poultry farms and dairy farms are nearly always, particularly the more intensive dairy farms, nearly always in nutrient surplus. And they will have nutrient to spare.
And I suppose the irony is generally also located not quite a distance from arable. But anyway, as you said, we need to get away from this idea that we can't move manures when we can quite clearly move fertilizer about.
Exactly. And we can, you know, if you do it properly logistically, you know, with a full size 27 ton Arctic tanker, you know, you can move a lot, and the nutrient value, particularly at the moment, is worth thinking about. The other big one, which we haven't talked about, is obviously digested sewage sludge. again, very high in phosphate because of the amount we've historically and currently use in washing powder, a great source of organic matter and phosphorus that over time will boost indexes. This last winter, I've come across a big arable farmer who's taken sewage sludge for several years, and an arable farm with indexes of 5 for phosphorus was quite startling. And they basically, they've been taking it for years to improve soil organic matter, which they have done, probably weren't recognizing the amount of phosphorus it was bringing with it. So it most certainly will build up phosphate indexes over time.
And in places where they are, where those water companies are spreading it, do you mean, are they doing soil tests to check, or are they're providing the balances to the farmers to put into their plans, or how does it work?
I don't want to put words in their mouths, but my opinion, there is a lot to get rid of. There's a relatively limited number of farmers who openly take it. There are paperwork and procedures involved to sign new farmers up. So it's easier to spread it on farms already in the circle and on the process. So what I think that means is they've historically spread probably more than they needed to for logistical reasons. I think as the farming rules for water regulations, that although they've been around nearly 5 years now, 4 years anyway, as they start to be implemented more seriously by the Environment Agency, the ability to spread more phosphorus on fields with indexes 3s or 4s will stop. And as a result, there will be more, the water companies will be looking for more farms keen to become involved in the process. And again, it makes sense. You're completing a circle. If you're, in this case, your lamb is being fed to someone that what they produce needs to go back to the field that produced the lamb to complete that circuit.
And there's a slight concern, isn't there, about sewage sludge on grazing land. We have to be, doing the sludge matrix and all that, we have to be quite careful about it. But it could be it will be a good source of pee for some of these fields on Christmas.
Yeah, it would be. So, reseeds, particularly if people are ploughing, I know in this case we're not, but reseeds or where there's some cultivation will reduce the risk. Post-final grazing in the autumn is an opportunity. Remember that we're really talking about the gradual release of inorganic nutrients. So we're not looking for immediate phosphate release in this case. We're looking for kind of long-term building up of indexes. So, a post-final grazing application will still retain the bulk of that phosphate for use the next year and the following years going forward. But yeah, you are right. There are rules that would prohibit. Yeah, there are possibly options after if you're shutting ground up for hay or for big bale or things like that, if you've got a long period of time between.
And I suppose the answer is years ago, it would have just been just dose everything with DAP, but the cost of that's gone up, hasn't it? And as you say, there's now opportunities for people who have excess amounts of nutrients. So be it a water company, be it big and dairy farmers, to actually make the use of or move nutrients around a bit more.
Yeah, I think it's a huge opportunity that higher price inorganic fertilizer is going to encourage this idea of completing certain nutrient circles. There is a lot of nutrient in I always say, whenever you get a group of farmers together, the solution is nearly always in the room, and because in that room there will be people with massive nutrient surpluses because of the system they choose, and there'll be people with massive nutrient deficits. And if only those farmers talk to each other, they could miss out all of the Audi driving sales reps by just sorting the problems out themselves. And I think that's a great, great, great opportunity. And I appreciate it would be nice if the dairy farmer or pig farmer was next door to your sheep farmer. But even if he's 20 miles down the road, I suspect if you do the economics, it's not as ridiculous as it might seem. I've talked quite seriously to people this winter about building the dairy farmers building slurry stores on the arable farms so that during the quieter times of the winter, they can move slurry to those stores on arable farms so that in the spring, if a spring crop in the arable farmers have got the stuff there and ready to go. So just trying to be a little bit more cooperative as to look at the bigger picture stuff.
Yeah, and as you said, it's utilising labour, isn't it? And
better
stores and so less water and all of that, and it's ready to go. And I take your point that it's been around for years, but there was a massive backlash against the farming rules for water that seemed to act as a bit of a surprise that you couldn't put muck on certain crops last autumn. And people like, well, you just can't you just can't use organic materials on arable crops. It's like, well, there's quite a lot of people who are. So it is encouraging people to change practice, isn't it? It's just making it, I suppose, taking that few steps on and thinking slightly differently about it, but and the infrastructure that's required for it.
I mean, farming rules for water, the interpretation, the EA's interpretation last summer got everyone, including us, in a flap because it was a massive, if they'd stuck with it, it was going to be a massive impact on the spreading of sewage. So something like 70% of the digested sewage sludge gets spread in the autumn. Well, that wouldn't have been allowed. So somehow you've got to find a home for huge volumes of that. You've got a lot of farmyard manure is spread pre-establishment of water sewer. So yeah, it was a massive issue. Now, clearly, DEFRA have issued some guidance to the EA to make it a little bit more practical and given opportunities to sensibly spread manures at perhaps at a wider window. But you know, there's no doubt the writing's on the wall in my mind that nutrient efficiency is going to have to improve in the future.
And I suppose I'm thinking of you drive around and see loads of liquid for containers, don't you, on farms? So do you mean it's the future is you just see lots of slurry stores on farm? It's the not quite the same, but it's the same infrastructures there ready to go when you need it.
I mean, the downside is, and you can't really get around this, the downside is obviously a lot of water in most liquid manure. So you've got relatively low dry matter and relatively low concentration of nutrients in each cubic meter or per ton. You know, that there are separators, you know, out there that can separate probably 20-25% of the solids out. So there are routes to make transport more effective. You know, and I've always argued pumps are an incredibly effective way of moving liquor, but obviously you've got to be relatively close for that. My idea of using the gas main overnight has never taken off.
It's just, it depends on the robot that's needed to clean it before the next gas line comes through.
Yeah, exactly.
But then I suppose it is about, well, I just think it's encouraging innovation. It has to encourage innovation, isn't it?
Yep.
We have to change because the way we've done it isn't open to us anymore. So we've got to think differently.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly right. I think reality is what we were doing was unsustainable in terms of nutrient. It was incredibly wasteful. And my argument always is, I think that there's some financial benefits here. You know, we're driven primarily in our advice by financial sustainability alongside environmentally sustainability, and to be able to reuse nutrient time and time again is incredibly efficient, and as a result, if the true cost, which we seem to be seeing now of nitrogen and inorganic fertilizers, if the true cost starts being attributed to them, these organic manures will appeal, you know, both price-wise and environmentally wise.
I think the challenge always becomes it's a knowledge exchange or information flow, doesn't it? Which is, I was asked by a farm in all seriousness, which is, can I grow grass without fertilizer? And you've just got to go and have a chat with an organic farmer.
Yeah.
Do you mean so the information is out there, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just about getting it out to a wider community, or them going to farms that wouldn't necessarily be like their farms, but actually you can learn a lot from them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I work with a couple of discussion groups. One particular, we are planning a visit exactly as you suggested to an organic dairy farm, because these guys are producing 75-80% of the volume of forage as a conventional farmer with zero nitrogen. And it's, you know, huge clover. Legumes are a huge opportunity. I read several years ago that, you know, the average farm in the UK, I think, uses 130 kilos of nitrogen. But if you get 30% clover in your sward, you can get 150 kilos provided. So if everyone were average, we wouldn't need to buy one ton of nitrogen for the whole of the UK's grass. You know, it's a frightening, the opportunity of clover, of legumes is kind of unbelievable. And just not take, so we need to become clover farmers, I'm telling all my clients. You need to, and all this issue about not being able to kill out docks without killing the clover, well, we just need to sort it out. It's not an excuse anymore. We just got to work out how you don't kill your clover when you spray your docks.
Yeah, and I think it's the attitude of irritating docks versus the cost of bringing in that clover or the nitrogen that clover could have done.
You know, weed wipes. You know, let's really reinvestigate weed wipes that only brush herbicide on the dock leaves, which are, you know, they're very different plants. You know, it's not as if you can't see the difference. There's got to be ways.
Well, and in the world of regenerative, also not worry about them. Get some dock beetles.
Fair point.
and certainly a lot of organic systems during an element of animal training. But anyway, that is that's a very simplistic, but it's
a positive. The crucial bit is what you're suggesting, which I 100% support, is it's a positive way of looking at the thing as opposed to looking at the negatives. The positives are, which we can't get away from, legumes offer the ability for many farmers, most farmers, to not need to buy inorganic nitrogen. That's quite a bold thing to say, but it's not new science. It's well and truly proven. I'm circulating at the moment a really good booklet produced from Chuggers in Ireland about how to incorporate white clover. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a fantastic summary as to how to go about it. And they've been produced time and time again.
And the challenge is, you sort of see, is that the farming system isn't quite as easy, is it? You don't just go to a shed, you get a bag out, you spread a bag, it grows. This particularly clover can be challenging, and you have to be careful at certain times of year in terms of how you manage it. It makes farming more tricky, but it's not impossible. It's a different attitude towards it.
It is a different attitude towards it. I'll go a little bit bolder than you. I'm getting older now. That I think we are sold as farmers systems that involve buying things off people. Clover is too cheap. You know, you establish a clover lay, quite rightly, as you say, you have to then think how you manage it to maintain that clover or build that clover up. But that's about on-farm activity. There's not many people who are going to come down the lane and encourage you to grow clover, because what that means is you don't buy as many things as you did before.
And that's always why grassland or nutrient planning is always, it's a bit of a market failure, isn't it? Because the alternative is actually it's trying to save farmers money and input, while the other is selling stuff.
The reality is clover, legumes more generally, do offer a great opportunity. And I fully support your principle that it's a more complicated. You've got to think about it. We've got to manage those swards quite carefully. But, you know, it's all possible. People are doing it. The organic farmers, there'll be an organic farmer in many parishes, stroke counties, who are doing it very well, thank you. And a visit to an organic farm would be a good thing to do.
And I suppose the GS4, back to Chris's farm briefly, but the GS4 is challenging him because you cannot put nitrogen on it. I mean, that's part of the agreement. You're being paid that money to not put any inorganic nitrogen on. And because of where he is on quite a big ridge of limestone in Lincolnshire, not renowned for its rainfall, it's thinking also with setting up mixtures that do better with fewer inputs. It's partly the thinking, isn't it? But it's also partly thinking about the mixtures. My challenge with GS4s is that they disappear
obsolescence, yes.
So you have to replace them.
Yeah.
And that's part of the deal in terms of that agreement you pay. But you're still buying inputs in. You're just buying in seeds rather than vert or feed or whatever.
So I don't know what you're talking about. Are you talking 3-4 year re-establishment? What's the time scale?
Probably. Well, it depends on, I think we're still learning how to manage them in terms of how to keep those herbs in them, but certainly herbs can disappear within a season if them too. It's generally that we're grazing them too frequently, so that the preferential grazing for the herbs kick in and they just basically get eaten out. There's challenges of how we maintain that herb population in them, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that's right. So if you try to do a bit of cost comparison, if you could save 150 kilos a hectare of nitrogen, that's £300 a year. So if you're having to reseed every year, you know, £300 is probably going to use up all your money you've saved on nitrogen. But if through your improved understanding, you can keep that herbal lay effective for 2-3 years, the financial savings of the legume would outweigh even if you had to reseed every 3 years. So, you've got to, every year you can make a lay last, it's a big financial saving.
Yeah, and those herbal lays, they transition into sort of a decent grass clover lay, don't they? The herbs may decline in population, but depending on the mixture, you are left with a good grass clover lay that continues. And then, as part of the agreement, you just have to then establish another area that's determined that says it's GS4. So we're still learning how to use it.
Yeah, it opens up another challenge, which is how do we incorporate clover or herbs into an existing sward? Because that's something that many people talk about. It's clearly in principle a great idea, but my goodness me, it's difficult to do consistently with, you know, and so that's another opportunity stroke challenge. I mean, obviously, my understanding of the herbal aid situation is obviously the deeper rooting nature of some of those herbs. Logically, going back to the farm we're talking about, the ability to mine, for want of a better word, nutrient from a wider area of soil would be a good thing. So GS4 on a lower index field might actually perform better than perhaps a relatively shallow rooted grass lay, because the roots are going to be working in a bigger soil area.
And well, it was Elizabeth Stockdale, I'm not sure she said it on the podcast, but basically a lot of those herbs, it's a bit like wildflowers. Do you mean when sowing wildflowers, you're generally putting them on lower fertility soils? They tend, because they're not having to compete with the fast growing grasses. So ironically, it might help the establishment of some of those herbs, because we're obviously going to put some pea on, but it's certainly not going to be high index peas for those grass or herbal lay establishments.
No, exactly. So I suspect you will find they perform better than if you put a straight grass lay onto a very low. Whenever you read anything about reseeding, whatever you're reseeding, the levels of pH, phosphorus, and potash are always highlighted as being important. Your challenge there is that you've got the pH right, but the phosphorus particularly is very low. And therefore, I think there's no way out of that inorganic phosphate establishment.
Yeah.
And I would also really suggest that you come up with a strategy to get organic matter, nutrient-rich organic matter. Is to add compost in its own right. That's a green waste. It's not going to be a great hit. You're after the potent stuff, poultry, sewage sludge, dairy slurry. All those ones which will have significant phosphate levels over time will build up those indexes, but it will take time.
Yeah, and it's about, as you said, and widening the net of where they might come from.
Yeah, so. Go look a bit further afield. And don't forget that the poultry, pig and dairy farmers have got real pressure. They won't let me say this, but they've got real pressure to improve their nutrient balances. So, you won't be knocking on a closed door. You know, the few times I have tried and successfully set up these slurry manure transfer virtuous circles, nobody's resisting. You know, your challenge will be your arable neighbours who will probably want to do the same.
Yeah, and what's interesting is I set up starting to formalise this sort of process of getting stock onto arable farms, or trying to connect arable farms who want livestock. But it's now the nutrient flow is as important, isn't it? Because those grazing animals are basically just recycling the nutrients on those arable farms and helping build organic matter through the crops they're growing for the animals. But actually the nutrient transfer is as important.
Yeah, I think the nutrients, you're right. I mean, livestock on an arable farm can only be a good thing. I think the point, particularly if you focus on nutrients, is where are the new nutrients coming from? And what happens is when we export a ton of wheat, when we export 1,000 litres of milk, when we export a lamb, a small amount of phosphorus goes down the lane. And we need, as a general principle going forward, strategy going forward, we need to be thinking, how do we replace those minerals that have gone down the lane? And that is really very relevant in arable and low extensive beef and sheep farms, where so much nutrient is recycled. If we start with an index zero, this farm will remain index zero forever unless you actively import phosphorus from somewhere. You know, it's not going to get better however many sheep and however many cover crops you grow. The rate of decline might slow down because you are retaining nutrient within the farm, but you've got to add something to that farm.
Potentially, there's different nutrient profiles at depth, but fundamentally, it's not a very full bank account, is it?
No.
Still got to add something to it.
And you know, and that doesn't in any way undermine the attempts that everyone's making. You know, the Mintil you talked about when you were establishing, all those things are really, really positive, and they will reduce the further decline. But the reality, like all these things, I always want to know the history. It would be fantastic to work out the long-term history of that farm as to how we've got to an index zero.
Arable crops.
Right. Okay. So, you know, arable,
historically.
So grain and straw, year after year, disappearing down the lane. inorganic nutrients being brought in, probably because of the area.
Yeah.
And they'll grow a great crop the year that they're in, but they're not doing anything for the indexes. It's so soluble, it either gets used or lost. But the good news is there's lots of stuff out there. There's a lot of people desperate to, or should be desperate to get it to you. It's just got to come up with a deal.
Perfect. We could do it in lamb, I'm sure. Kilos of lamb per ton of something.
Well,
you know, bartering is coming back.
Yes. I mean, the old straw for dung one is quite common, but I always think the livestock farmer loses that heavily on that because they're not, no one's really ever accounted for the nutrient that the arable farmer's getting back. But
there's a few more getting a bit savvier to it and now are starting to charge for it or increase the amount of straw they get back and making decisions about what farm it goes to based on the year of straw they've got. So they are starting to appreciate the value of what they've got, definitely. Anyway, thank you very much, John. It was really useful. And just is that idea that it's in stages, isn't it? We've got to do a bit now to get that level A going, but it is a long-term commitment to that land to get it back to where it needs to be.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly right. Two stages, short and medium.
Perfect. Thank you very much, John.
I'm now joined by Ian Robertson from Sustainable Soil Management. So we're going to talk through a more detailed soil test that we did with Chris. And this was to try and get an understanding of total and available cations really within that soil. So Ian, it's quite an interesting one to try and explain on a podcast because it's a report with quite a lot of numbers. But what we'll try and do is take out some sort of the key points off this report. But it might also be useful just to give a bit of a background about this test and why farmers should be doing it.
Yeah, hi Liz. I'd agree. It's quite a complex bit of paper we're looking at, lots of numbers all over the place. So we'll try and make it simple. My only excuse of making it complicated is that soils are quite complicated. It's never quite one-dimensional, so there's lots of information we need to look at. The history of these detailed soil tests are basically trying to understand why a soil performs like it does and trying to do a quite straightforward chemical test that alludes to the biology and the physics of the soil. We tend to find that one-dimensional chemical extract doesn't tell us what's happening with the physics and the biology. We kind of get it around our necks a little bit and think, oh, we're really good biological, but actually, why is it so good? Because the physics are good and the chemistry is good. And conversely, we can have issues where the chemistry is really, really bad, and that affects the biology, obviously, all the way around. So what we're looking at here is a whole raft of parameters, and I think for the case of everyone listening, we'll probably keep it to about four or five that we'll look at that will highlight some of the key things on the soil test. And one of the starting points we always look at is the laser texturing, so sand, silt, clay fraction of your soil. And that really is because those sand, silt, clay affect soil structure, potential workability. They lead into things like the bulk density. So no one will be surprised when I say that sand weighs more than clay. And although everyone jokes that sand is easy working, sand has a very high propensity to go down very hard and tight, which means you can get a very high bulk density. And as soon as you get a high bulk density, you get compaction layers, if you like, very easily coming into your soil, which really have an issue with rooting. And also on very small structure, you're looking about the water capacity, and that sand gives you water. It drains it very easily. It doesn't hold it. If it's not holding it, it means it dries out quickly, which can then significantly reduce the microbial activity.
And so the soil that we had tested at Chris's sits around about 60% sand. So it's classified as a sandy clay loam. So that would link into that. It's can be quite challenging or prone to compaction. It doesn't necessarily hold moisture, and it's in a dry location. So
the key sounds really silly thing to say to you, but once we know that, we can then start to manage it. If we didn't know that, we keep scratching heads going, why is it compacting? Why does it keep droughting? What can we do to try and sort it? But knowing that it's droughting because it's a sand or high sand content, we can then address it. So well, we really need to look at increasing organic matter cycling. And then if you take that fact and look at, okay, we've got high sand, we then look at one of the other key parts is that it has got quite a high level of organic matter at 6.1% on the loss by ignition scale. when that's analysed with the DUMAS method, which is a different method, it drops down to 2.2, which is really a carbon reading, which is quite a good level for that soil type. Now, this is where it all gets potentially quite complicated, in that raw organic matter, which is what your loss by ignition standard organic matter test tells you, is literally raw organic matter. What we're really striving for in our soils is some raw organic matter, but we want the humus content. And the humus content is when the raw organic matter gets broken down by microbial activity and builds humins, humic acids, those type of things, very small particles that hold soil structure together, hold water, increase structure, functionality of soils. So when I look at a soil like this, it's got a 60% sand and it's got 6% organic matter, something kind of the back of my mind goes, well, maybe it's not cycling as it should do. Maybe that organic matter is not breaking down as quickly as we'd like into organic carbon, humus, etc.
So I suppose we sometimes see when we look into grassland, sort of that a build-up of dead and decaying leaves, don't we, on the top, and it just sits there. So yes, it's got high organic matter, but it's actually not functioning within the soil. So it could be an indicator. I suppose it's also going to have a look at the field, but it could indicate that sort of.
Yeah, that's again, really good thoughts, is that you've got that thatchy feggy layer, as we call it. And if you look at that, that's a huge powerhouse of energy, lots of organic matter. You imagine it, you take that layer home, you dry it, and you put it in the log burner, you get a lot of heat from it, a lot of energy. So when it's sitting there as this layer of organic matter, it's not really doing it anything. We want that organic matter to break down. Instead of getting heat from it, we want to turn it into carbon dioxide, nitrogen, copper, zinc, boron, all those elements to then feed our next the grass that we're trying to grow, rather than simply keep applying it. And if we can do that, we will then reduce the amount of inputs we need and grow more grass. And it sounds a little bit contrary to general run at the moment, is I quite like organic matter being broken down into carbon dioxide, because the carbon dioxide then feeds your grass with the stomatas on the underside of its leaves to grow and cycle. That's what nature does, just go round and round. And if we don't have that carbon dioxide breaking down, the grass, one of the limiting factors to that grass could be carbon. Because 43-45% of your dry matter in your grass is carbon. It has to come from somewhere. So that's either out of the atmosphere or it's out from our soils, the microbes breaking our raw organic matter down into carbon dioxide to feed our next cycling plant.
So the hope is that it's quite a closed cycle, not quite closed, but it's doing it. It's feeding itself, isn't it, in terms of what's coming out of the soil?
Yep. Well, that's the beauty of grass, is microbial activity is going to be everywhere. The microbial activity breaks the raw organic matter down, turns it into its constituent parts. The grass drinks that, grows a bit more, puts a bit more of a solar panel up, pushes more sugars, carbons into the soil to feed things like mycorrhizal fungi that will sequester more long-chain carbons in the soil. So every soil will respire. Where you've got grass, you've got the ability to capture and cycle. Your phrase is lovely, it's closed cycle. If you take a bare field, soils will still respire, but there's no green material capturing that expired carbon dioxide to then close the cycle and bring it right round again.
And so in terms of this farm, during on previous bits of the podcast, we talked about bringing organic matter in, or sorry, organic materials in to boost the P level.
Yeah.
But actually, it's also understanding we've got to get what's there cycling as well.
Yeah, that's, again, when we look at these soil tests we've got here, we've got two measures that we do. We do readily available plant accessible phosphorus, for example. And the number here we've got is 28 kilos per hectare. And then we look at the total level of phosphate, which is a really nasty, strong chemical extract that we do. And that is giving us a reading of 2,377 kilos of P2O5 per hectare at the top 15 centimetres. Basically saying that we've got very small amount cycling, but we've got a huge amount of reserve. So we would also talk about this, like the fridge in your house has got 28 kilos, you've got 2,300 in the freezer. What can we do to get it out of the freezer to make it more available? Now, the biggest thing that cycles phosphate on most soils is microbial activity and or root exudates, so pushing the plant, pushing root sugars, carbohydrates, acids into the soil to then cycle that phosphate. And when we look at the numbers here, there's not a lot of cycling. And that makes me wonder, well, is it because the soil's got structural issues? Is it also because actually it's quite a high sand content, although it's got loads of organic matter, it's gone very dry? And when it goes very dry, the functionality of the soil microactivity stops. Therefore, you're going to stop that phosphate cycle.
So we probably do, we need to apply some P to get the, particularly in this example where we're trying to establish some herbal lays, but we've also got to have a bit of a long-term plan to get that, the soil, or to investigate the soil structure a bit more to see whether that is a limiting factor, but to get the, basically to get the, what is present in the soil cycling better, and that will be through biological activity within the soil.
Absolutely, and the biological activity is again, as people realise, it's, you know, you need your soil to have some air and water in it to get microbial activity, biological activity going. If there's two things that sort of stand out slightly on the results is we've got high sand content. That high sand content makes a high bulk density, which can cause the soil to compact. The second part that we've looked at is that when you look at the total extraction of elements with the aquaregia extract, you're looking for about 6 calciums to 1 magnesium in the soil. Not unavailable, it's in the total levels, because what happens is that calcium pushes clay apart and holds them apart. Magnesium pulls them quite tight together. And if you've got a lot of magnesium in your soil, it pulls the soil tight, which can be helpful on sand. But when it pulls it really tight, it doesn't release the water. So you get a sort of compacting layer that doesn't allow water to go through it, but also doesn't allow water to be extracted by the plants. And you end up creating a dry, hard layer or dry, hard soil that basically shuts the functionality of it down. So you can have all the food in the world in the deep freeze, but what we're trying to do is get it cycling. And we've got some things here that might stop it cycling.
And so, well, the history of that field, it's on a limestone ridge. So in terms of calcium, it's what's impressive is how much how that balance has become slightly out of kilter, really. So in terms of what are options to try to help that ratio start to come back in towards a better balance, I suppose?
Well, the easiest thing to do is to apply some calcium to the soil. And if we apply calcium in the form of calcium sulfate, then the calcium sulfate gypsum, recycled plasterboard, for a lot of people are using. The calcium sulfate goes into the soil, the sulfur reacts with the magnesium and forms kieserite, Epsom salts, and that can potentially leach down through the soil, putting calcium onto the clay colloids, and that calcium holds the soil structure further apart. Now, that sounds wonderful. However, if we've not got good drainage, it matters not. Because you can make all this exchanging sites and pushing calcium magnesium around, but that has to go down through the profile with the drainage water. And that's why anywhere we're doing sort of gypsum work or asking people to look at gypsum, we also look at making sure they've got surface aeration or grass and subsoiling potential, but allow the water, natural rainwater, to come in and actually percolate through rather than go in, sit in a wet layer and then evaporate back out, because otherwise it won't do anything without drainage.
Okay, so there's options, or we've certainly got to investigate application of gypsum. Well, no, firstly, we've got to dig some more holes at Chris's, then think about whether gypsum, or certainly within a trial, we could look at seeing whether gypsum would help just to relieve some of this.
Yeah, and it's a tricky one. This bit of paper is a brilliant bit of paper. I've not been on the farm, which is sort of my excuse, but if you look at it and say, well, the numbers would tell me that potentially you have got hard layers, you know, or not quite as bad as a two-day soil. That's what high magnesium soils are like. 2 days at too wet, 2 days time at too dry. It swings really quickly. But certainly I'd be digging holes to see if that is the case. And then I'd be looking priority. Before I started applying lots of nutrition, I would look at a priority of aeration and gypsum before I started feeding anything else into this.
And I suppose that's the challenge of being in an area of it's not a huge amount of rainfall. I mean, it's just north of Grantham. So we tend to go, oh, but it's just because it's dry. Do you mean we're not having a huge amount of rain? But actually, it's, as you say, the humus and all of that, we can have functional soils in dry places that still maintain good grass growth.
Yeah, I think the key there is we know organic matter, and again, I think it's the wrong phrase, organic matter will improve your water holding capacity. But what we're really talking about is humus, and humus will help you increase your water holding capacity. Lots of raw organic matter, like a thatchy layer, imagine like a peat layer, can get very wet and then very dry, and then it rains on it and it gets hydrophobic. And it stops the water actually penetrating it. But humus will not do that. When it's broken down by microbes, it actually allows the water in. Here, we would, if we've got that high organic matter layer, which we have, I would like to, again, potentially aerate it and get the microbe breaking that down and turning it to humus, which in turn will allow much better use of any rainwater you get and store more water in winter. It'll pull water into it and it'll hold it within the humus layers.
So it's, I suppose that leads us to thinking about the establishment methods, don't we, in terms of, so if we do, if we've identified that during the, it does need some aeration or maybe or a subsoiler, in terms of it's then it's building that into the establishment technique, doesn't it, or sort of getting in before we're trying to destroy the existing sward to put some to new in, yeah, to make sure the soil structure is right. We've got a bit of time, I suppose, on our side.
Yeah, that's it's one of the biggest things I've seen with experience with grassland is people stitching in new grass seeds and running over with a direct drill, or you know, even raking them in over the surface. And actually the seeds will germinate because they always will, but they never really take that well because we've got a hard compacted layer at 4, 5, 6, 7 centimetres down below.
Okay.
So I'm a massive fan of digging holes, using steel where we need to. I don't care what type of steel, but some form of steel, and making sure we've physically broken it with steel, and then you allow the roots of what you're putting on as a seed or natural regeneration to then cycle. Or allow the roots to go in and cycle, feed the microbes, and get all the food that we've got in the freezer to come and play for us.
And I suppose just on that, in terms of, because it is a, although we've had some rain recently,
yeah,
in terms of how digging holes when it is a bit like concrete is quite challenging. So is there techniques we can use when soils are drier to know whether it's compacted or just dry?
Yeah, it's something we often see. We do all dig holes in August. Again, it's a bit unfair on grass, but certainly with a combinable crop, we dig holes in August after we've combined. You go in there and you get your spade and you hit that the ground. You go, blimey, that's hard. I've got compaction. You know, rip it up. However, 9 times out of 10, what you've got is you've got a hard, dry soil. If you think of your hard, dry soil a bit like a breeze block, you tap a breeze block, it sounds really hard, but you break a breeze block open, it's full of air bubbles inside. But it's got a hard exterior. So what we tend to do in those situations is grab a lump of soil, maybe the size of a computer mouse or your fist. And if it is dry, you then put it in a bucket of water and watch all the bubbles come out of it. And if your soil bubbles, you've got a PED, which is a natural aggregate. If you put your lump of soil in the bucket and you get one bubble out of it, you're much more likely to have a clod, which is a man-made aggregate. And then when you leave the soil in that bucket for, say, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, bring it out, and then gently, if you can, break it apart. You'll find the water has gone all the way through that soil. And the reason why it felt that it was compacted, because simply it was hard and dry like your breeze block.
Yep.
If, on the other hand, you try and break this clod and it's slime in the outside and you break it open eventually and it's dry through the middle, you know you've got serious compaction because there's no air in that clod.
I suppose the challenge within grassland, what we do about that compaction at that time of year is a different matter, isn't it? Because it's a lot of techniques aren't really going to help, but at least it gives us an indication of in time what we need to do. So as it starts to get wetter in the autumn, we could go in with some form of something to do with the compaction.
Again, totally agree. Find it in the summer. Please, no one aerate in the summer. Don't do that.
I once went to a farm where they had done it, and they just was beautiful dead stripes of grass with light, and sort of they'd pulled loads of clods out. It was a very dramatic looking field at the end of that.
Yeah, you look like you're giving it measles or something, right? And you've got these dead bits of grass everywhere because you just burnt them off with the lack of rain. Aeration is a brilliant, brilliant bit of operation. Lots of machines to do it. I'm a massive fan of doing it from a dry to a wet front. So we do it at the end of the summer, maybe after your last grazing round or whatever. Beat it up then. You've then got all the winter rains that come through. And those winter rains then percolate down, taking iron or whatever you're taking through, keeping the soil warmer for winter and then setting you up for spring. It's quite difficult to do a lot in the spring because you're coming from a wet to a dry front normally.
Yeah.
And suddenly people say, oh, yeah, I did that. Oh, it went too quickly. I didn't get time to do it. It went too dry. So that's why, generally, as a rule, I'll always try and do it late.
In terms of just that last final question, really, obviously, we've talked a bit about soil carbon and how often should we be testing for it? So, Julian, we've done this test with Chris now. How soon would we do another one?
I mean, you could test every year. I think you'd get bored because you might see incremental improvements. You might not. We normally test every 5 to 10 years on what we're looking to do. It all depends on what we're doing. We, you know, are we about to do a really vigorous attempt at carbon building, or are we going to just maintain what we're doing? Because fundamentally, if I came in here, we might see that we would drop our organic matter by doing some of the things we're talking about, like aeration, etc. And I wouldn't be worried about that, because I would match it to the offtake or the carbon sequestration by the grass we're growing, and also hopefully by the reduction in bagged inputs and that we'd be doing. So you're kind of offsetting the reduction in carbon in your soil to an improvement in, what's a better word, cash crop production.
So getting on, I suppose, going on a step. So the fact is that we can track progress, but going up is not always what we want to achieve, is it? It's sort of, in part of this is understanding, and the complexity of this soil test is working with someone who helps you interpret what a number going up or down really means.
Yeah, absolutely. You could, soils have to respire. They will always release carbon dioxide. Otherwise, we'd be 40 foot deep in dead leaf litter, for argument's sake. So you look under a hedge, yes, it is good, but it'll get to an equilibrium of carbon level in that soil. And then the trees, you're cycling, you've got a closed loop. I think you discussed it earlier on. There's a brilliant closed loop. What we must do, try and get to that closed loop to really reduce the amount of carbon release we are releasing to do it through fossil fuels and fertilizers, simply. You know, so machinery or cultivations and fossil fuels. And then get that closed loop to work really, really hard at building stuff into the soil and growing you a cash crop.
And so so is the key points for Chris at the moment is short term, in terms of really focusing on getting the new lay established well, and then sort of a long term planning in terms of getting it a really functional soil that sort of keeps, the ambition is to not have to put it in again, but it was just get that soil functioning well. Growing loads of grass helps the soil. Do you mean, so it's getting that cycle going, isn't it, on the farm? But it's short term, yep, might need a bit of inputs, but longer term.
Yeah, you're cranking the flywheel. You're priming the pump, if you want to call it. You know, get some aeration, get a bit of gypsum maybe. Let's grow different depth of root architecture with different species in your grass lay. You know, let's use, I don't know how deep the soil is here. You know, if you're on limestone, you should never drought, because you should have a nice big aquifer your roots can get into and pull out from. So let's use some different species. Also, yeah, there's all sorts of things we can do. But I would agree with you, the initial point is that we need to just prime the pump, look at, you know, dig some holes, look at it and see if we've got to hit it a bit hard with some aeration and a bit of gypsum. Let's do it, because that will really improve the efficiency going forward long term.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Ian. Thanks for joining us.
Lovely. Good to see you, Liz.
If you have any comments about this podcast or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.